This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. On the line with us, Alex Lawson, the Executive Director of Social Security Works. SocialSecurityWorks.org is the website. You can tweet him at ALaw202 or at SSWorks. And Alex, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. The Trump administration is up to no good when it comes to Social Security. Well, I shouldn't just say the Trump administration. This is the entire GOP, isn't it?
It is.
So what are they doing?
I think it's actually interesting to think of it as they, you know, Trump made all of this noise that he was going to be different on Social Security, on Medicare, on Medicaid. And now that is just so fully out the window. He's nothing more than just a continuation of the Paul Ryan perverse dream that he says he admits he's been having this fantasy since college, stealing people's earned benefits and pushing seniors into penury and an early grave. And Donald Trump is just a wholehearted cheerleader of this effort now. The tax scam being the latest push towards that. And now we just have, from this retreat at Camp David, we see what they're going to do when it comes to this spending. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors here, but coming out of Paul Ryan's side of the hill is just going to be complete aim at Medicaid, at Medicare, and when they can, at Social Security.
Well, and not only that, I received an email from Social Security Works. I got one today, and I got one last Thursday or Friday, both pointing out that the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress, particularly Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, are gung-ho for basically cutting the number of people who work at the Social Security Administration so that when somebody turns or gets close to 65 and they try to apply for Social Security or Medicare or need any help on the website or whatever it may be, that instead of having, you know, a 15 or 20 minute conversation with somebody over the phone or in person, they're going to have to go someplace, sit, wait for hours at a time, sit on hold for hours. It's going to be just a nightmare experience. So pretty soon people will be screaming, you know, the Social Security Administration sucks. I want Wells Fargo to run this thing.
That's exactly right. And that is, in this spending bill, they cut Social Security Administration funding by $500 million, right around $500 million. This is on top of the billions of dollars that they've cut from it every year, year after year. We call this the death by a thousand cuts attack. So they run into fierce resistance when they come a frontal attack at Social Security. And we will always make sure that's the case. We also hit back hard when they come at the funding because this is, you know, what I say, this is their MO. So they kneecap the mailman and then they complain that the mail is late so that they can get rid of it and give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And, you know, privatize.
Right, they literally did that with the post office in 2006.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's so they don't really have, as you know, and your listeners know, they don't have many, you know, many tacks, many strategies. They really only have one, which is reach into your pocket, steal your money, give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street, and, you know, call it privatization, and somehow it's going to deliver better for you when that's never the case. So right now, that is the first on the docket is this funding fight over the Social Security Administration, SSA. And just let me point out, and I know you know this, but the height of annoyingness on this is that it's not, no one's giving anyone anything. This isn't their money. This is our money. Not only do we pay for our benefits on Social Security, we also pay for the salaries of the people and the buildings and all of what it takes to administer those benefits also come out of our contributions that you see in your paycheck. So it's literally these guys on Capitol Hill who are restricting the use of our own money to get us our benefits. They're just setting it up to be as annoying as possible. Longer lines, longer wait times, difficulty of getting information from a new, underpaid, and undervalued staff. that's the nightmare that the Republicans want to create for all of us.
Yeah. I played a clip in the last hour of Franklin Roosevelt saying, let me warn you about the smooth evasion, you know, that says, of course we love Social Security. Just give it to us. We'll do more of it. We'll do it better. And best of all, it won't cost anybody anything. Is that the sales pitch the Republicans are doing? I mean, you know, Trump during the election, during the primary, I remember him standing in the Republican primary saying, I'm the only guy on this stage who will tell you all these guys are going to cut your Social Security and Medicare. I am not going to cut Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. Well, he's already cut Medicaid. He's already cut Medicare with the last budget with this tax deal. And now he's going after Social Security. What, you know, when are Americans going to figure out, A, that Trump lied through his teeth in order to get elected, and B, that the Trump crime family, you know, Trump, Ivanka, you know, everybody says, oh, Ivanka, she's a liberal. Isn't that wonderful? It's nonsense. The Trump crime family is totally down with it, with whatever holds power for them. They don't give a rat's ass about the average working person.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, whatever, I didn't believe him at all when he said it. I also knew that there was no way he could take the rest of the Republican Party with him. And at its base, it's clear that this guy, Donald, cares about Donald. That's it. And whatever it takes to maintain power for him and his family, that's what he's going to do. And what that means is actually following Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and their plans. And we know what those plans are. It's to steal our money and give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. Paul Ryan openly admitted that he's been fantasizing about this since college. So to think that somehow he's going to stop doing that, it just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, what evidence is there for them to, that they're not going to do this? There's none. And yet, they literally, they're all the Trump care bills, the whole purpose of those was to destroy Medicaid, to raid Medicare, and to give that money to Wall Street. Their tax scam is the exact same thing. So time and time and time again, this is what the Republican Party does when they get power. And anyone who gets power through the Republican Party will also have to play this same game. This is a song that they dance to because Wall Street is pulling all of their strings.
So Alex Lawson, Social Security Works, right now, the Republicans in Congress are planning, you know, they have been for some time, and they're planning to make it even worse, cutting the salary of Social, you know, cutting the number of people working in the Social Security Administration so that your and my experience of Social Security becomes miserable. Why is that not being reported in the corporate media?
You know, the
seems like the biggest
media,
story of the year.
The corporate media, they hate Social Security because they're, you know, they go to the same cocktail parties, the same Wall Street cocktail parties. It's one big family. It's one big party, and we're not invited to it. So they're obviously not going to report on this critical issue. It's only truth tellers like you and other truth tellers out there, you know, Richard Esgow and the Zero Hour. You know my whole spiel about, before we have a political revolution, we need to have a media revolution, because you will not hear critical stories like this from the corporate media, because they want this to happen. The reason you didn't hear much about the tax scam is because they wanted this. This is the best thing to happen for the seven corporations that own almost all the media that we consume. That the tax scam is exactly what they want to happen. I want to say here, though, Tom, that we can beat this one. We can beat this SSA funding one because the Republicans are going into this negotiation incredibly weak, coming out of the Camp David discussion.
So real quick, how do we beat it, Alex?
Call all of your senators and demand full funding for the Social Security Administration.
There you go.
Okay. Easy one.
Call both your senators and your member of the House of Representatives. Full funding for the Social Security Administration. Alex Lawson, SocialSecurityWorks.org. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. And welcome back. Glenn in Fort Bragg, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hello, Glenn.
Well, hey. That's my first time calling in. I'm a proponent of a bipartisan project to finish Franklin Roosevelt's largest public works project in Washington State. And as you know, probably, Governor Inslee has just been elected to represent the Democratic governors across the nation. Mm-hmm. And he'll have direct input on this project. And I'm a strong proponent of saving Social Security, but I've promoted this project now for many years.
What is the project, Glenn?
Well, Franklin, before World War II started, he put in a project of 500,000 acres. It's supposed to go out to 1,000,000 acres of irrigated ground. Mm-hmm. And they've never completed the second half of the project. And with so many people unemployed and everything, I want to take this to the table. And I actually have taken it through Kathy McMorris Rogers. She's delivered this to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And what I'm asking him to do is sign an executive order like Franklin did to initiate the project. But I'm asking him to sign 3 executive orders for funding on the project and to have it done by 2022. And I was wondering if you would be willing to work directly with Governor Inslee and Senator Patty Murray. I think she's the 4th highest Democrat in the nation. On this project, and I was wondering if Mr. Alex there would also work directly with you and the governor on this issue.
Yeah. I don't know enough about it, Glenn, to comment, but, you know, I will say, you know, Jay Inslee is a good guy, and Patty Murray is a great senator, and if either one of them, you know, want our help in any regard, it's always available to them. You know, it's just okay, you know, pretty straightforward.
Preparing a email to send you the information.
Okay.
I was hoping you and Mr. Lawson would review the website.
Yeah, I'll check it out. Again, Glenn, what's the name of the project?
It's a fast-track completion of the Columbia Basin Project.
Columbia Basin Project.
Largest project, yes.
And this was for to prepare the land for agriculture?
Yeah, it's for agriculture. Also, it's for the communities and stuff. It's tremendous. It takes in over 500,000 acres, so that's a lot of acreage. And it will help all the communities, Spokane, Moses Lake, the Tri-Cities. It'll help Washington State and the nation. It's actually an international project when you go to thinking about all the food goes. It goes to every corner of the world.
Right.
And so,
if this is so viable, Glenn, why has private industry not developed this property, or is it state parks?
It's a money issue. You know, it's a several billion-dollar project,
right?
And no, Bill Gates can come over and put his money into it. But then again, you know, it's a deal about leadership and.
Yeah,
I know you're a strong proponent against Trump, but you could help force him to go sign these executive orders. You know, bring your talent to the table.
We'll do our best. And Glenn, thanks a lot for the call and thanks for the heads up. I was unfamiliar with the Columbia River project, and I will have to check it out. We'll be back. And this is, I mean, this whole Social Security thing, this is amazing. It's and the fact that it's just functionally not being covered at all is also amazing. Interesting piece in Science Daily. This came from BMJ Today, and I'm not sure what that is an acronym for, but it's a journal. But in any case, the headline, Could Sugar Be Responsible for the Obesity and Diabetes Epidemics? I thought we had kind of already decided that it was, but this is, you know, there's a whole bunch of scientific journals linking back to this issue. And pointing, doctors have long suspected sugar is not simply a source of excess calories, but a fundamental cause of obesity and type 2 diabetes. And that now cost us $1 billion a day to treat. $1 billion a day we are spending treating diseases caused by the fast food industry pouring sugar into, you know, whether it's through sugared drinks or whether it's sugar in the buns or the French fries or God only knows what all. Certainly high fructose corn syrup in the ketchup. I mean, it's just you can't get away from it, right? And the past decade has seen a renewed interest in the possibility that caloric sweeteners, particularly sugar and high fructose syrups, have major roles in causing obesity and diabetes. And what they're arguing here is that it's not just like extra calories that end up being converted to fat, that particularly the fructose, particularly the high fructose corn syrups, that these are chemicals that our body is not, we did not evolve consuming these. In nature, basically the only two places that you can get these concentrated sugars are in rotted fruit or super ripe fruit. And even there, you've got lots and lots of fiber along with the sugar, or honey. And there wasn't that much honey consumed by human beings throughout the history of human evolution. And so our bodies didn't evolve to deal with 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 grams of sugar a day. Our bodies evolved to deal with basically no sugar a day, or just the sugar that's found in fruit that is completely balanced appropriately by the fiber that's in the fruit. So anyway, our geeky science for the day. Back to my piece in Alternate, Time to Overthrow the Rulers. I was quoting from both FDR and Eisenhower, and then I get into how in 1972, September of 1972 specifically, Lewis Powell was confirmed by the U.S. Senate to the Supreme Court, and nobody even knew that he had written the Powell memo. It was a year later that Jack Anderson, the investigative reporter, tracked that down and publicized it. In fact, I've got a link to the original article here. And Jack Anderson, you know, wrote about this, that Powell recommended a militant political action program ranging from the courts to the campuses. And the result of this, the 6,000-word rant of Lewis Powell's, is literally today's political landscape. Powell encouraged, before he was on the Supreme Court, and then once he was on the Supreme Court in 1976, made legal the complete capture of our political world by people of great wealth. And people of great wealth on the right saw capturing politics as a great way to increase their wealth. People of great wealth on the left thought, well, you know, things are going okay. We'll just, you know, let's put some money into cancer research or something like that. And so what has happened is that the right wingers stepped up. They did what Powell said. And they took over our government. I mean, it's a truly breathtaking thing. And this is, by the way, not a new assault on government. I point out that in the early 1880s, they were called the California Railroad tax cases. There were six cases that came out of California that all went to the U.S. Supreme Court when Morrison Remick Waite was the Chief Justice of the court. And in every single one of these cases was the railroads trying to establish that under the newly passed 14th Amendment, it had been passed about 15 years earlier, that under the new 14th Amendment, that they should have the same rights that human beings had. Delphin Delmas argued against that in the Santa Clara County case. I talked about that last week or maybe the week before at some length. And the clerk of the court, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, he simply wrote in the headnote that Morrison Remick Waite, the Chief Justice, said, oh, yeah, corporate personhood, it's fine. It's a good thing. It's already done. We've already decided. We all agree. And thus we got corporate personhood without the force of law. The headnote in a Supreme Court decision has no legal authority. The court decision itself says we didn't need to go to the Constitution for this. In other words, there was no change in corporate personhood. But everybody said there was because the clerk of the court said there was. And in response to that, 2 years later, in his State of the Union address, Democratic President Grover Cleveland said, and this is in his State of the Union address, and I quote, "The gulf between employers and the employed is constantly widening and classes are rapidly forming, one comprising the very rich and powerful, while in another are found the toiling poor. As we view the achievements of aggregated capital, we discover the existence of trusts, combinations, and monopolies, while the citizen is struggling far behind in the rear or is trampled to death beneath an iron heel. Corporations are fast becoming the people's masters.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick note on the flu. Apparently, we've got this H3N2, if my memory serves me right, which is not the normal flu virus and apparently was not included in the vaccine this year. Although the other viruses that are in the vaccine may cause a sufficient immune response that for a small percentage of people, and it's a definite minority, they actually have some immunity against this flu if they had the flu shot. But the vast majority of us, you know, with or without the flu shot, are just vulnerable to this flu. And so, and it's a particularly nasty one. It's actually, more people have died so far this year from the flu, you know, by a substantial number than had died last year or the year before. This is a bad flu. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the years where the flu is really, really terrible, they tend to be years where you had also insanely cold temperatures around the times of the flu outbreaks, typically in the weeks leading up to the flu outbreaks, because there's a certain gestation period for the flu in your body as the viruses hatch and convert all of the nuclear material of your cells into viral DNA. Or RNA is the case, depending on what kind of virus it is. But what they found is that the thing that most affects the viability of the flu virus, its ability to both survive and transmit itself, is the amount of humidity in the air. And this, I've got a couple of articles here, one from Consumer Reports, another from CBS News. This is the CBS News one, says, using absolute humidity, in other words, measuring the amount of moisture in the air, explains 50% of influenza transmission and 90% of viral survival. So the bottom line is this is why we don't have the flu in the summer, or at least part of it. Now, there's also, you know, certain types, the avian flu, for example, is transmitted by geese and ducks, and they seem to move it around the world during migration times, which correspond with the beginning and end of winter. But the stronger correlation is with dry air. So the net of this, if your air is really dry, you're really vulnerable to catching the flu because the virus is more active and it's more transmissible. That would be like on every airplane, because airplanes just take outdoor air, which is insanely dry at 30,000 feet, and, you know, heat it up and pump it through the cabin. When they heat it up, they dry it out even more. So flu viruses would survive really well on airplanes. And, of course, in any building that's heated during a real cold snap, particularly when the temperature outside is below 32 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 Celsius, that's when, you know, the moisture all starts precipitating out of it as snow or rain or you know, frost or whatever, and the air gets even drier. So, bottom line, might want to get a humidifier. Anyhow, Carol in Monessen, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today?
I think I'm going to stay in until May.
Yeah, there you go. What's up? What's up?
I'm calling about Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question regarding Ryan's stance on this, his obsession, really, to take away our Social Security.
Right.
I have a two-pronged question. One is, what sort of economic society does he expect to evolve from this policy if the elderly don't have Social Security? That's number one. And number two, what does it benefit people like Ryan to want to do this? What is their motivation for this? I mean, forget the fact that they want to privatize it. Just taking it away, for example, hating it.
Right.
I mean, what sort of society do they envision would happen with a lot of these people who, like my husband and I, who are on it? We spend a lot of money. We're homeowners. you know, we've got kids and grandkids, and we spend money on that. And you multiply us by millions that are on Social Security and have that income. What is that going to do to the economy? Those are my questions.
Sure. Paul Ryan's libertarian fantasy is that basically everybody should be and is able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and if they fail to do so, it's their own personal, individual moral failure for which they personally and individually should suffer. That's it. Now, for that reality, and it sounds really nice to upper middle class white college students, which are the principal people who are buying and reading Ayn Rand's books and subscribing to libertarian philosophy. And Paul Ryan certainly falls into that category. But for that to work, and you can build the logical structure for it, right? You know, but it would require, first of all, everyone to have white male privilege, number one. Number two, it would require everyone to have absolute information about the marketplace, about everything that's going on everywhere, so that they can make informed consumer and political decisions, and which also is not the case. And number three, it would require that the starting points all be equalized. That if somebody is born into a white family that's got for generations has had education and comfort and family equity, homes and things like that being passed down, the family can help out their kids going to college, those kind of things, that a poor black family must be brought up to that level. Now, Paul Ryan's theory does not accommodate any of those realities. So he's operating off what I think is best called a theology, a religion, a belief system that has no evidence to support it. And so, number one, that's where it's coming from. I mean, this is the sales pitch that Ayn Rand makes in Atlas Shrugged. It's the whole libertarian thing. You know, now in terms of your first question, which is what does he get out of it, or maybe it was your second question, what does Paul Ryan get out of it? What he gets out of it is wealth and power. You've got
How so?
You've got seven banks on Wall Street that are multi-billion-dollar institutions that if they can get their hands on that $2.67 trillion that's sitting in the Social Security Trust Fund, they will make tens, if not hundreds, of billions of dollars in profits, which can be spread among the shareholders and the chief executives, the senior executives of these banks, and can be handed to the politicians who did the work of handing that money over to them. And we see this over and over again. Billy Towson, for example, the Republican congressman from Louisiana, led the floor fight to make it illegal for Medicare to negotiate drug prices from the pharmaceutical companies back when they were doing Medicare Part D. He was such a toady for the pharmaceutical industry, he actually succeeded in getting that done. To this day, Medicare cannot negotiate prices. You've got an individual pill of penicillin may have a one pill retail price of $5. When the Army buys a million of them, they get them for 20 cents, but retail are $5. And if you're on Medicare, Medicare pays that $5. And Billy Towson, after he got that done, actually got a waiver from Congress so that he could leave Congress 6 months early to go to have his $2 million a year job as the head of pharma, the lobbying organization for the pharmaceutical industry. Paul Ryan is looking at the same possibility. If you do the work for them, this is the same thing that the guy who was the number two whip, Eric Cantor, you know, when he lost his seat in Virginia, boom, you know, instant multi-million dollar a year paycheck. So what Paul Ryan is looking at is that if he can hand off $2.5 trillion to the banks, then all he has to do is leave Congress and the banks will have he will die worth hundreds of millions of dollars and be able to pass that along to his children. That's the bottom line. That's what these guys are all looking at. That's how corrupt our system has become, Carol.
That's truly horrifying. What about all the people right now who are, say, maybe 50 years old, 40 years old, who've been working these low-paying jobs? How are they going to take care of their elderly parents who aren't going to be able to work after a certain point of time? I mean, once you're 70, 75, I mean, you've got physical problems, you don't have the energy, you don't have the ambition even, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how are they going to care for their elderly parents? What kind of poverty is that going to bring on this country? That's horrifying.
Well, you know, what Paul Ryan would say was, don't worry, the private economy and the big banks will take care of everybody. We've all seen how well that works out when the big banks have complete control over us. But that's what Paul Ryan would say. What I would point out is that in 1930, you know, in the early 1930s, before Social Security was put into place and before it came along, one of the major causes of death among people, elderly people, people over 65, one of the major causes of death was hypothermia in the winter, heat stroke in the summer, and malnutrition-associated diseases that exacerbated things like the flu and pneumonia and stuff like that. They, you know, they just didn't, they weren't able, many Americans, I mean, you consider, you know, more than half of Americans have basically no savings. The average American family right now, if they lost their job, would be homeless within 6 months. I mean, it's just the situation, the fragility of our economic and political situation right now, just as the result of the changes that have occurred since Reagan 36 years ago, the cuts to the social safety net, you know, the so-called reform of welfare in the 90s in the Clinton administration, the radical, you know, tax cuts and cuts to benefits that came out of the Bush administration. We don't have the kind of social safety net that we really need any longer. I mean, it's just not here.
I
mean,
now that
in this last budget they actually put a chained CPI on these programs, or actually it's on our tax increases. What's going to happen is that over time, the taxes of people who make less than $300,000 a year are going to creep up every year because of bracket creep. Carol, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back in just a minute with Bob Nay from Talk Media News. Stick around. And welcome back, Don in Kansas City, Kansas. Hey, Don, what's on your mind?
Well, I, too, am kind of a fan of FDR. And he made a statement that you just keep leaving out that I don't understand why, because it can connect to every Republican president that we've had since then, other than Eisenhower, possibly. But the only thing we need to fear is fear itself, or we have to fear is fear itself.
Right. That was from his first inaugural address.
Right.
1933, okay. January of 1933.
Lyndon Johnson, he did some good things. I mean, there's no question about it. But they keep shooting themselves in the foot. Why didn't he prosecute Nixon? He knew he was, we got it on tape. He knew he committed treason.
Because he couldn't prosecute, LBJ could not prosecute Nixon because Jerry Ford had already pardoned him.
Before he was elected, he knew it. He didn't want to bring it into the
You're talking about in the 60s. Well, yeah, you're right. Lyndon Johnson was not president after Nixon. He was president before Nixon.
What would happen to our government?
Yeah, no,
well,
you're right.
I'm sorry. Look at our government now.
Yeah. Here's the problem. Lyndon Johnson did not figure out that Richard Nixon was messing with the Vietnamese. LBJ had negotiated an end to the Vietnam War in the summer of 1968. They were going to announce it in October of 68. That would have guaranteed that Hubert Humphrey, the vice president, LBJ's vice president, would become president. Humphrey was running against Nixon in the election of 68. Nixon went to the South Vietnamese and said, hold off, don't do this deal. You know, wait for me and I'll make you rich. That is now a fact, because we've got the audio tape of LBJ telling Everett Dirksen that in late October of 1968. So you're right. Lyndon Johnson was president for 4 years, Lyndon Johnson was president for 3 months, knowing that Richard Nixon had committed treason. He knew this in October of 68. Right. He left office in January of 69. That's when Nixon was sworn in.
He was afraid of what would happen to our government.
That's right. He was afraid that if the American people learned that the next president had gotten there by treason, that we would have an illegitimate presidency and that would damage our republic, particularly at a time when the Cold War was going on and both Nixon and, well, both LBJ and the rest of the country were afraid that the Soviet Union, we might end up in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union.
Boy, so, that worked out, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, okay. We didn't have the nuclear war, but I, you know, in hindsight is 20/20, Don. I agree with you that LBJ should have, when Everett Dirksen essentially said to LBJ, "I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do," and then when Richard Nixon called him up a couple days later and said, "Oh, I didn't do this. I would never do this kind of thing," LBJ recorded those conversations. He should have handed them over to Charles Kuralt or somebody at one of the big networks and said, "Here, run with this." He didn't. He should have.
He should have, and look at where we're at now. That didn't work.
Yeah.
And then we come up to Reagan, and
he did the same thing with Iran.
Iran-Contra. I mean, you know, and I'm pretty sure that they knew about that ahead of time. And even if it was after the fact, why didn't they? You know, and maybe the Congress wasn't there at that point. I don't know, but it seems like to me we had a Democratic Congress and.
Now, with the Iran deal, I don't think even the Republican Party knew that Bill Casey, the guy who ran the Reagan campaign in 1980, that Bill Casey had actually cut that deal with the Iranians. I don't, you know, if they knew, I would be shocked. Don, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. On the line with us is the author of Sideswiped, Bob Ney, former Republican congressman from Ohio and now a world-class reporter. Bob, you were the only member of Congress who spoke Farsi, the official language of Iran, and you were the guy that the Iranians came to and said, "Hey, can we work out a deal with George W. Bush when he was president? We're willing to recognize Israel. We're willing to stop the nuclear program." Et cetera. I mean, you really know what's going on in Iran. And in your newsletter today, you had just some really startling information about what's going on in Iran right now. You want to bring us up to speed on this?
Sure, Tom. You know, it's a big deal. If you look way back when the ambassador from Switzerland to Tehran personally came to D.C., Karl Rove denied this happened. He had a conversation with me on an encrypted line about this document. He asked, "Is it real?" I said, "Yes, it's real." Vic Snyder, a Democratic member from Arkansas, is all aware of this, you know, and can verify it. The White House rejected it at that point in time years back. The centrifuges could have been reduced. Israel would have been recognized, and Hezbollah would have been disbanded. So I wanted to get that all out in the open.
And why did the Bush administration pass on an opportunity to completely clean up the whole mess with Iran?
Well, the administration, the people within the administration told me point blank there was a tug of war. There was one side that wanted to do this. They wanted to entertain this deal because basically it's what happened eventually, you know, down the road, but it could have happened, with the same scenario. And the difference is inspectors on the ground, American inspectors, would have been allowed into Iran. One half of the administration wanted to do it, the Colin Powell half, I'll call it, and the other half, the Cheney half and the Rumsfeld half, absolutely put their foot down and refused to do it.
Wow.
So that half won out. That's what happened. Later on, it was recognized, although Condoleezza Rice testified lack of knowledge of this whole agreement, it was later recognized through Colin Powell's chief of staff, this agreement surely was sent, it was over there, and was rejected. So
yeah.
That's what happened, the Cheney half.
Yeah, I think Wilkerson has acknowledged this. In fact, you might have done it on my show back.
I was called a liar, the whole deal was said didn't exist, it did exist.
Yeah.
Later on, of course, you know, we have the Obama administration, which was stopping the nuclear Iran. And now, and I point out in the articles, because it's very, very important, that as this 90-day process again comes up, which, by the way, I'm going to predict to you that Trump will try to get rid of doing that every 90 days is what's
right.
going to happen, Tom.
Which would actually probably be a good idea, because every time it comes up,
sure.
it's a political irritant for him.
Right, and I understand why President Obama did it. It was a verification method. It keeps Iran honest. It keeps us.
But it also politicized it by throwing it to Congress.
Right, and Trump threw it 90 days ago to Congress. What did Congress do? The Republicans who screamed so much about this, they did nothing. It just silently came and went. Now, this time is a little bit different. I would argue on this after looking at, you know, what Rouhani, the president of Iran, is saying. He's saying, hey, open this up. Let them have Facebook and Instagram. Let the youth be able to, you know, have some freedom. So this is going deeper than economics, but economics is a large part of this. So now, this week coming up, President Trump is going to have to make a decision once again. This one is even more critical than 90 days ago, because if, in fact, we go down the path of, you know, of decertifying the deal, we go down the path of increased sanctions, the clerics in Iran who don't want freedom are going to be able to turn around and say, you see, it's not us who are starving you, the Iranians. It's America that's doing it. So this is a very delicate situation. I don't know how Trump is going to react.
Trump is playing right into the hands of the hardliners in Iran.
Oh, he would. If he reacts any other way than except to say, you know, look, you know, we're going to let nature take its course. We're not going to add additional sanctions. Then it falls back into the hands of the clerics. They can't say that we, the United States, are doing anything. They can't say that our agreement is faulty, because if you look at what they're saying there, they're saying, disband Hezbollah, pay attention to us. You know, we want freedom for ourselves. We want jobs and opportunity for ourselves. Pay attention to Iranians. If President Trump doesn't understand this policy or doesn't listen to Tillerson, because I honestly, Tom, think that Secretary of State Tillerson knows what to do on this. I really do. Mm-hmm. But if Trump doesn't listen to him and just downplays this and makes it very, you know, uncomplicated and a very trite thing, and turns around and just says, oh, you know, we're going to slap these additional sanctions, we're going to go after Iran.
Well, don't you think Trump is going to do whatever Fox News tells him to do?
Well, no.
That seems to be his only source of foreign policy information.
This is interesting, because Fox News has a news correspondent called Ali Reza Jafarzadeh, and he, in fact, was head of the Mojahideen Khalq. I have one of his business cards, because he denies he was head of it. They raided his place out in D.C. I can't make this up. And this guy is sort of the Ahmad Chalabi of Iraq. This guy is the misinformation group that likes to believe they would be the democratic rulers of Iran, which they wouldn't be. And they're all ingrained. They provide material to Fox News. They're the ones who want war. They're the ones who helped Saddam Hussein actually go against Iranians who were gassed during the Iran-Iraq war. So they are actually, he is an official part of the Fox News organization, and he's not what Iranian people want.
Wow.
Yeah,
amazing.
Well, there's so much to this that everybody just passes right over. He's an official news correspondent. He was head of the terror group.
Incredible.
Right.
So what else is going on? So you know, pray for peace with Iran. So what else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, you know, turning to domestic, there's the DACA situation coming up. I think Trump, as long as he could even get the name of a mention of the word wall, Tom, would do anything, frankly, right now, probably, that the Democratic side wants. But Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are going to have to deal internally with members of Congress. Now, there are groups that are getting frustrated with Schumer and Pelosi right now, and they want them to do a government shutdown. But if that happens, that kind of is the Ted Cruz health care route. I don't think they can actually do that and come out with that.
No, it's going to be real interesting to watch all this. Right. Bob Ney, Congressman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.